She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And I'm going to warn you all, get ready to hold on, because is this guest ever going to give us all quite a bit to think about? Our show today is sponsored by the Chapman Automotive Group in Tucson, Arizona, who sell four of car and driver's top 10 greenest cars in America. And believe me, we thank them for their support. So what a very different and exciting show we have planned for today. Please join me in welcoming Philip Bonini, professor and Canada Research Chair in Public Ethnography and professor in the School of Communications and Culture at Royal Roads University in Victoria, British Columbia, and co-author of Off the Grid, Reassembling Domestic Life. Philip and his partner, Jonathan Taggart, are you ready for this? They traveled across Canada to find off-gridders and visit them in their homes. And I don't mean like off of, the big highway. They went off-grid. I was terrified reading some of the descriptions of places they went, but they visited 100 homes and interviewed about 200 off-grid Canadians, as well as many Americans and British expats living in Canada. Oh, the stories he has to share with us. And I'm laughing because I am, if you Google least likely to ever off-grid, probably my picture will show up. And so reading it to me was a vicarious thrill. And Philip, thank you so much for writing the book and giving us that intimate look at what you experienced and for being on the show today. So that was a long intro, but you deserve it.
Thank you for having me.
So let's get started by telling people what is an off-gridder. It's not turning off your cell phone and going away from your computer for a day. What is an off-gridder technically?
You're right. I hear the expression all the time, and often it's used to denote someone who wants to run away. I mean, I've heard people who say, you know, they're running away from the law, they're living in the bushes, and they say they're going off the grid. Well, it depends on how they live. The technical definition is actually quite boring because it comes from the engineering world, and they basically look at how connected your house is. So if you are disconnected from electricity and natural gas, you're off the grid. It's as simple as that. Now, in actuality, once you cut off the wires and once you cut off the mains that connect you to your original utilities, you find yourself making other choices. You might be self-reliant for water. You may take care of disposing your own garbage. You may be very selective about what kind of media, communication media, you let into your house. You may move really, really far away from a city. But all those things are not necessary for someone to be off the grid. What's necessary and sufficient is, do you make your own electricity? Do you make your own heat? In that case, you're off the grid.
Yeah, and the answer here is no, and not any plans for that in the future, which is probably part of why I absolutely love the book. So a couple of things before we get into the actual book. I want to ask you, what made you and your partner literally commit 2 years of your life traveling to every province and territory of Canada, which is the big, vast expanse, okay? It's not like traveling every county in New Jersey. Why did you do it to find out why and how people live off-grid? What inspired you?
Yeah, about halfway through the journey, I realized that Canada was actually the second largest country on the planet.
It's big.
And I was so
thankful that I
didn't live in Russia.
That might be the next book.
Yeah, no, I don't think so.
No, I don't think so.
Um, this story is really simple. In 2010, I moved from a small town of about 5,000 people to the place where I live now, which is a very small island in the Strait of Georgia. So not too far from the San Juan Islands in Washington State, actually, quite close. And here, our island is about the same size as Manhattan, only instead of 3 million people, we've got 4,000 people. On this little island, even though it rains a lot, it gets quite dry in the summer. And so we need to learn to be very cautious when it comes to our use of water. We each have our own water wells, and we're all very self-sufficient when it comes to water. And that was the first time that in my life I had a resource, namely water, that was my own. There wasn't a city feeding water to my tap.
Right.
I did not have an inexhaustible resource. I had to watch my consumption. And so I had to start teaching my kids things. Like, for example, if it's brown, flush it down. If it's yellow, let it mellow. And that was at the time
when
my daughter was... My daughter was learning how to, you know, go to the toilet by herself. And so this was part of her learning curve. So immediately, because I'm interested in way of life, I started thinking, okay, what would it be like if it's not just water that you're self-sufficient for, but what if it's also all the other things that make your life possible, you know, like power, light, heat, food. And so when I started asking myself that, I became aware of the fact that there were many people who lived this way. It was called off the grid. And so I was crazy enough, I suppose, or adventurous enough to put in a grant proposal, and I was very fortunate. I got the money. And the story goes that when I received the money, I started traveling not too far from my home here in British Columbia. And things are quite different here on the coast, on the West Coast, than they are in the rest of the country. It hardly ever snows. There's no ice.
Right.
We can grow food year-round. And so I thought, this is really interesting, but it's also really partial, because what is it like to live off the grid in a place where, you know, the temperature goes down to minus 40?
Right. It's not the tundra.
Right.
Just even that word terrifies me.
and at the same time, the West Coast is also really expensive. I mean, to afford to buy acreage, you sort of need a little bit of land to live
right
off the grid. You have to have some money. But this is not the same for the rest of the country. So the regional dynamics were interesting enough that I figured I wanted to travel across the country. It was also a beautiful excuse to see this large country. And at the time, the story goes, I had a research student who had sort of volunteered to work on a project with me, and I called him up. He was working part-time on a tugboat not too far from Vancouver when he picked up my call, and I said, John, I've got this grant. There's the opportunity to travel across Canada for the next 2 years to the most incredible places, and you would get paid for it. Would you be interested? And I heard a definite pause in a very English way. You know, he's got an English background. In a very English way, he said, yes, I think I can fit that in my schedule.
I think I can take 2 years of my life off, and we'll do this thing. Very English.
Yes, you know, very. You know, he was still a professional photographer, so he was really looking for a project to work on, and so everything really worked. And next thing you know, we're unfolding a map, and we're trying to figure out where to go.
It just sounds that simple, and it's so not. And this is probably a question I should leave, or just a comment to the end of the interview. But one of the things that literally made me laugh out loud in the book was when you said people asked you, how did you find off-gridders if they were off the grid? And you said, I Googled them and emailed them, and they answered me back. And I'm like, okay, so there's that connection, which we can get to. But again, one more question before we get into what I call, there's two more, the meat of the book. You used a really innovative technology, and I think you called it innovative ethnographies.
Right.
You use cutting-edge technology to write and publish the book. And when we spoke briefly off air, you said, I know it's a long book. And for everybody listening out there, it is not a long book. It is a storybook about you want to read more and you want to know what it was like and how did they flush the toilet and what happens when their desalination system broke. So, disclaimer, not a long book. And part of it is the beauty in which it was written, the multidimensional view. So can you talk about that a little bit, why you chose that way to present the book to the world?
Yes, I think it's because I have a limited attention span. and, you know, as a
Maybe
generation
that's
X,
why I liked it. And I'm not kidding. It just, you're always mixing it up.
Thank you, by the way. You're very kind. I'm a Generation Xer, and I've grown up with the TV as my babysitter. And so I love reading books, but every time I read a book, I feel the urge to watch the movie about it. And if it hasn't been made, I can't wait till the movie's made. And at the same time, I feel like, you know, looking at pictures. And when you read a book, you often get nothing but black and white pictures. And
right.
So my idea has always been, okay, what if I write a book that actually has beautiful, colorful pictures and a movie comes with it? That would be great, right? And so it wasn't until recently that we could do this. And a lot of people now read their books on Kindle and similar
right.
readers
right.
or their iPads and whatnot. So I basically wanted to write a book that you can click on things, not on everything, but on specific things. And that clicking takes you to the book's website, which I'll do a little plug. It's lifeoffgrid.ca. And you can see pictures of the places we're going. You can see video clips. You can hear sound clips. Or you can actually hear the interviews, clips of the interviews. And then the great thing about it is having Jonathan there, who was also a videographer, allowed us to make a movie. So there's that as well. So it's a very interactive. And if people were really not into this, there's also the print version that is, you know, classic paper-based.
But it's what makes it exciting. And you also refer to the book as a hybrid. And as, you know, Mrs. Green, I like that term. Is that why you call it a hybrid? Because it so fits. It's not just a book.
That's right. Yeah, it's not just a book. It's a lot of different things. And it's also, here I am, you know, a professor working at a university. And so it comes also to an issue of audience. I mean, I could have written a book that was for academic colleagues and probably would have been read, you know, maybe by 25 people, which would have been great. But I didn't want to do that. I thought the story was were good, and so I wanted to have a hybrid audience as well, made up of both academics and non-academics. And so the challenge here was to convey stories in a way that were, to borrow from your language, that made people think without burdening them with terminology, excessive jargon, and all that stuff. So it attempts to do both. It's hybrid in that way as well.
And admittedly to me, like a sexiness and an allure of, you know, going off the grid. And after I read your book, I was over that in like 5 seconds because it is, I cannot imagine. It is not an easy life, no matter how much money, no matter what you do. I think there are things that I'm not willing to give up. And I was very clear about that. Maybe you said go for 2 weeks and see how you can handle it. And I was thinking about the overnight stay to make sure that I didn't want to do it. But let's talk about some of the real people in your book, because I think that will make the story so real to our audience. And you first introduced Alistair and Eleanor, and they literally live on a floating home, and it sounds beautiful, and they have views of the ocean. So that was your first one, I think, or it was the first one you introduced in the book anyway. Describe it as best you can, what you found. Where were they?
They were in a relatively undisclosed location in Clearwater Sound, and I'll tell you what's undisclosed in a second. But Clearwater Sound is basically off the west coast of Vancouver Island, in probably the most scenic town in all of Western Canada, which is called Tofino. And this place was really unique because the home was not a traditional home sitting on a piece of land. It was
right.
actually sitting on a piece of water. But it wasn't a boat. It was a floating structure that had been built on floats, a relatively small place. But in global standards, probably a bigger house than many people in Asia
might
have. The uniqueness of it was that I couldn't get there. I needed a boat. So Alistair very kindly served as my water taxi driver, took me to his house. As I arrived, you know, I very carefully stepped on the floating structure, which was quite narrow. careful not to fall into the water. And I can't really say that I've ever been to a house where, you know, I need to careful not to fall into
the
ocean.
I'm afraid I might fall in. I've never been to such a structure, trust me.
That's right. And it was incredibly normal in a way. I mean, it wasn't normal in the sense that instead of hearing a dog barking across the street, you had a heron, a blue heron, staring straight into the living room window. And it wasn't normal in the sense that, you know, people in the country might have some mice in the foundations. They had sea lions and otters chewing away at their foundations. So it was very different and incredibly revolutionary. But at the same time, it was a home with beautiful indoor plants and a guitar, and the radio was on, and the kitchen smelled nice and warm, and coffee was on the stove. And so despite the fact that it was nothing like you or I have ever even seen before, it was a home. And you felt it right away as you entered. And so from the very beginning, it was obvious that even though the very notion of a house had been reinvented, the notion of a home was still the same.
Was there.
And I think that's what the book really is about.
It really, really, really is about that. And then right up front, I think it's great to address, I think there was in me anyway what I expected to find, unfortunately, were more stereotypes. People that were oddballs and loners and, you know, I like to fashion myself as an ex-hippie, but not an off-gritter. What were they like? I mean, most of the people that you interviewed, I would want them to be my neighbors. That's how I felt.
Right. No, absolutely.
They might not want to be my neighbors, but I would want to be their neighbors.
You know, the theme of normality, in quotation marks, keeps coming over and over as you read the book. I mean, of course, the typical off-gridder is an eclectic person who has a very strong need for independence,
right,
and for challenge, and someone who's very skilled and very self-educated. So we're not necessarily talking about average people that, you know, go to the shopping mall every Saturday.
Right.
But at the same time, I was always annoyed throughout my research by the portrayal of off-gridders as lunatics, runaways, or somehow oddballs, hermits, people that you're sort of scared of. And
right.
I never felt that way. I mean, if I had felt that way, I probably would not have completed this project, because I would have been uncomfortable going into their homes for supper, for lunch. We slept in people's homes for several days at a time. And there was never any of that. I mean, there was actually, like you said, good neighbors that I too would like to have.
And it felt peaceful. Really, I mean, when you described their home, it felt very peaceful, which is something that I think I do seek. I mean, I do like to go to the mountains and stay in a cabin where there's nobody nearby and hear only the birds. And I'm not just a city dweller that goes to the mall, but there is a peace, a separate kind of peace that you captured about people that truly want to stop the noise. It wasn't weird at all. It was like, just let's be quiet. So believe it or not, we're going to have to take our first break. And I said to you in the beginning, we'll never be able to cover the entire book, but we'll get to more pieces of it. I'd love to tell you to tell about the second story of Tracy and Grant, because that was even harder to get to. So everybody, I'm sure you are going to want to stay here with me. And you've joined me in welcoming Philip Vanini. He's a professor and Canada Research Chair in Public Ethnography and professor in the School of Communications and Culture at Royal Roads University in Victoria, British Columbia. But why he is being interviewed by Mrs. Green is because he is the co-author of Off the Grid, Reassembling Domestic Life. Philip and his partner traveled across Canada to find off-gridders and visit them in their homes. And when we come back, Philip, I want you to describe in a little bit of detail where Tracy and Grant lived and what it took you to get there. I mean, I was literally exhausted reading about it. And was it easier to get to an off-grid cabin than to visit a floating island? I was like reading it and talking out loud to myself and saying, what? So anyway, everybody stay here with me. We'll be right back with Philip Bonini. Lots more fun stuff to share about living off the grid. Think blue. Think beyond green. Think TDI clean diesel technology. One part of the Volkswagen Think Blue initiative, our goal of creating and encouraging eco-conscious products and behaviors. This is Mrs. Green. A car that can drive a long way should still make you want to, well, drive a long way. Volkswagen Jetta's TDI clean diesel is a high-mileage vehicle that lets you stop at the filling station less often so you can spend more time enjoying the road. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI.
Find everything you need for your next adventure at Bookman Sports Exchange. Buy it new, buy it used, or trade up and go where you've never been before. Explore this big backyard we call Tucson. Bookman Sports Exchange has the gear you need for anything from a quick day hike in Sabino to a long backpacking trip through the Grand Canyon. Bookman Sports Exchange, open daily, located on Speedway, east of Country Club. For details and more information, visit bookmansports.com.
Ready to clean out that garage? Goodwill offers you 40 convenient locations all over southern Arizona. And at every one, you'll be greeted by a uniformed Goodwill employee trained to assist you in unloading your items, prepared to offer you a receipt for your tax-deductible donation, and grateful for something you won't get anywhere else.
Thank you. Because of your donation, I have a job.
The gift of Goodwill. For a list of Goodwill donation sites, go to goodwillsouthernaz.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And I want to do just a quick shout out to invite you to consider becoming a sustaining member of Mrs. Green's World. And people I've been talking to about it lately, it's really like the PBS model. And I'm sure they wouldn't mind me saying that at all, because your support will help us to keep our broadcasts free and independent and to continue to bring you informative shows like this one, addressing issues that impact all our lives. Because this isn't just a show about entertainment and people living off-grid with our guest today. If you just joined us, our guest is Philip Bonini, and he and his partner, Jonathan Tacker, traveled across Canada to find off-gridders and visit them in their homes. And the result was a book, Off the Grid, Reassembling Domestic Life. And my point is, it's great to have people like this share their stories and talk about how it can impact our lives. So visit MrsGreensWorld.com and consider becoming a Mrs. Green sustainer. So let's go back to you, Philip, and talk about couple number two, which is, and I can't go through each couple because there are so many people. And mostly that I read about, and I said to you, I didn't read every single word, but I obviously read a lot of it. Were they almost all couples? I didn't read.
No. It was actually some single women, some single men.
Single women?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
And of course, the ages were different, lifestyle sections. Right. I even met not too far from where I live. A couple in their 70s who were living on top of a small mountain alone in their 70s. Even though it was a lot of couples and it was a lot of families, the families were very diverse.
Right, right. So yeah. Tracy and Grant, how did you find them? And they, when you described where they lived and how to get there, I literally was exhausted.
So first of all, how did I find them? It was easy. They found me. when I started the project, there was quite a bit of interest locally in the news media. And so I was out doing an interview like this. And next day I received an email from them saying, come and visit. And it made it really easy because I was planning on going to visit there anyway. And by there, I mean really close to where I live, as the crow flies. There's an island a very large island, really, that is completely off the grid. And by completely, I mean not a single house on that island is connected to BC Hydro, which is our local utility.
Okay.
The reason why they are that way, as opposed to our island, which is much more gentrified, is because a few years ago, the local utility, again, BC Hydro, asked them, about 500 of them, if they wanted to connect to the grid, and they said, no, thank you.
They said, no. I read that to them. I'm like, okay, they like the way they're living.
Precisely. And so the entire island is off the grid, and it was a little bit like looking for fish in a barrel for me. I just had to get there. No, getting there was easy once I had an invitation like that on the table. Physically getting there is not terribly easy. For me, I needed to catch one ferry to go to the main island and drive up the highway a little bit, stop the car, and then find a passenger boat, not a ferry boat, a passenger boat, because one of the things that they don't want on that island are lots of cars. So if you want to get to Laskiri Island, you need to leave your car on Vancouver Island. And once you get to Laskiri Island, unless you want to spend the money for a taxi, there are a few cars around, but there are no paved roads. You need to bring a mountain bike or walk. And in our case, John and I each brought our own bikes, and we started going back and forth on this very hilly, very muddy, very long island to do our interviews. And the first one was at the opposite end of the island, which meant arriving for this interview quite disheveled and definitely not very professional looking. But then again, Les Kitchens are used to people covered in mud and sweat.
Right, so they probably didn't even notice.
Absolutely, no, they didn't. We really fit the part, as it were. And once we arrived at their house, it was, you know, a very beautiful cove, sun-based, because it was southern exposure, ideally as it should be. And, you know, this was one of my very first experiences in an off-grid home. I mean, everything was really new. Things that I had never seen before were appearing from every drawer and every cabinet, ranging from non-pluggable toasters to,
you're kidding.
To showers that... Well, no, it's actually quite easy. I mean, you might have gone camping sometime and used a metallic grid that basically you can put on top of a you can put on top of a stove, or you
right.
can put it on top of a campfire, and it basically toasts your bread as well as a toaster would, but without any wattage.
Right.
You know, that was one, but I could go on. I mean, one of the most exciting things for me to see was their shower, which was outside in the field. They had, I believe, 15 acres, so there were no issues with privacy. And their shower basically consisted of a black plastic hose left at an angle on a piece of plywood facing the sun. And just about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, even in the middle of the winter, that hose would have absorbed enough radiation from the sun that the water inside,
wow,
which was fed down the hill
right.
From a pond, was warm enough, and they basically showered, and at the same time they showered, they also watered a tree.
Right.
That was, you know, part of...
Water harvesting, structure. Yes.
Absolutely. I mean, you could see the tree with the fruits growing on it, and at the same time there was a bit of shampoo bottle on the branch. It was actually really... really funny that way. And so again, I mean, this was a very unusual way of living, and they were doing it on the cheap. But one of the things that I soon learned is that being off the grid doesn't mean living like that. And as I started traveling more and more across the country, I found ways to live off grid that were incredibly normal, to be almost suburban, and with a bit more money, you could definitely live a very rural, even urban, existence that by all standards is quite normal, with showers and with flushing toilets and all those things.
And some of what we call the comforts of home. I mean, really and truly, it not always roughing it and having to take, you know, cold showers and all of those things and go out and hunt for your meat and all of those other things that I find quite challenging. What was happening for you on this journey personally? Were there learning curves that were sharp for you, or did you have to start reevaluating? I mean, what was happening for you? Because not only did you embrace it, you decided to make it longer and really go much more deeply into the wild and all those things. So what was happening for you personally, if you don't mind sharing it?
No, it's fine. I mean, a couple of things happened for me. I'll begin by saying that I'm not the most handy of guys. I mean, if I need to change a light bulb, I'll call a friend. And so for me, learning about how to build a home to make use of passive solar energy, or how to install an inverter so that you can convert DC to AC, was basically Dutch language at first.
Right.
And I thought I would never learn. But as I started to learn more and more about the subject and meeting people, I became actually encouraged to learn more about it from a technical perspective. Not that I could build an off-grid home tomorrow, but I could definitely easily live in one. And,
right.
And if I can say that, anyone can say that. So in a way, the first lesson was encouraging. It was a sense of, I can do it. And the other was a greater sense of awareness of how uninvolved we all are in the functioning of our homes. You know, my light comes on when I flick a switch, but
right.
I don't really know where that electricity comes from. And it wasn't until I started doing this project that I realized that I could trace the origin of my light to a particular dam on a particular river not too far from where I live. And at the same time, I could also trace the idea that anytime I flicked that light, or anytime I wanted to toast bread in my toaster or watch TV, I could, because that's what life on the grid is like.
Right, without even thinking about it. You just come home and you turn
right.
on the switch, and if it's hot, you turn on the air conditioner, and if it's cold, you turn on the heater. It's not a conscious thing. You just do it.
Precisely. We don't want to think about it.
Right.
I mean,
I don't want to think about where my electricity come from, because I know,
well,
and it drives me crazy.
Sure. Or, you know, we don't want to think about where last night's dinner goes once we flush the toilet, right?
Exactly. I definitely don't want to think about that.
But the great thing is that once you actually do start thinking about it, you realize that how these things happen is not necessarily the way you would want them to happen. And so, you know, leaving lights on in a room that I'm not in, I don't think about it. Or maybe I didn't used to think about it. But
right.
once I realized
right.
the consequences of what that does, then I really want to change my behavior. In a way, so the second lesson for me was one of awareness and involvement, because I started thinking, if we all became more aware and more involved of what generating energy actually means, we would then be much more responsible with it. And off-grid living does that to you, because it's your own. You can't waste something that you've actually worked so hard to generate.
And
I think that's a powerful lesson there.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt at all. I'm sorry.
No, okay.
I should let you finish.
No, I was actually done.
But it is an important... I didn't want to let this application go by. It's an important takeaway for people that are listening as to why they want to read your book, because there are applications for our life on the grid. And I love the when it's yellow, you know, let it mellow, when it's brown, flush it down. It's in my book that's coming out in a couple of weeks, because that when you start connecting to the consciousness of either depleted resources or finite resources or the sourcing, like to me, sourcing, where does my electricity come from? The less I can use, it's kind of like the guilt reduction plan. So your book, because of these people's conscious choices to live in a much more sustainable way for the most part, there are things that we can do on the grid to help contribute to the overall health and greater good of the planet. So it wasn't a book about someone else's journey, there were takeaways for everybody to learn. And I think that's really important that people understand that. It's like, you really want to read this book, and you're going to email me and say, I loved it, Mrs. Green.
But, you know, you're precisely right. This book would have had a very small audience if it were just a curiosity piece about the eccentric practices of a small group of individuals. I mean, the point was, what is it that these people can teach us about energy, and also in particular about renewable energy, because we hear all the time, I mean, energy resources are dwindling, they're becoming more expensive, the world is becoming hungrier. And so we know, we hear all the time that we will have to rely more on renewables, but we're hesitant, we're anxious. And so what I wanted to do with this book is actually show a glimpse of the future by looking into the present lives of the people that are already using renewables today. So there's a lot of lessons in there.
There are a lot of lessons, and most people are not going to live off-grid, but millions of us better learn how to live more efficiently on-grid. That was one of the, just a reminder for me, of living more consciously. And what about, I was very curious about, not stereotyping, but generalizing. It's a much better word. The people you met, did you find that there was an integrated consciousness about, you know, they really wanted to eat healthier food, or did they live off the grid, cared about electricity, so packaged food was good or a necessity? What were some of the other, you know, conscious characteristics that you observed, if any?
Well, I would say that the greatest majority, if not all of them, were actually, if you don't mind me using the metaphor, were off the broader grid. We're much more critical about the way the world works. We're much more conscious of the consumption decisions they made. And I mean, you brought up food, which is a great example. To live off-grid doesn't necessarily mean that you need to grow your own food. If you remember the definition, it's got nothing to do with food.
Right, exactly. But
as it turns out, at least 80% of the people that we met grew a significant amount of the calories that they actually consumed in their gardens, in their fields. And it didn't really take much. One off-grid family that we met in downtown Edmonton, which is, you know, one of the largest cities in Canada, is right in the middle of downtown, had a small garden in their backyard and also had an allotment garden somewhere else in the city. They were growing a lot of food in Edmonton, by the way, where it's really, really cold.
Right.
And so in that way, they had disconnected themselves from the supermarket chain. And they were a lot more, they were making conscious decisions about local and organic food. And so those were really great examples about things that we all can do if we have a little bit of garden space, or if we're willing to go to a community garden where we can do these things.
And I mean, I've had so many guests on my show about food and everything you can think of, food scarcity, food deserts, food insecurity, food waste. And I think you make a really good point. Everybody can do a little bit. If you just grow your basil and a couple of things in containers, even in the middle of New York City, everybody, it creates, you know, a greater good for everything, and using, you know, less reliance. I mean, when you think about, I live in Tucson, Arizona, talk about a food desert. Most of our food comes in from the, you know, from the trucks that are rolling in, even though a lot of it is, you know, just over the border. But it's a consciousness of, you know, that whole off the grid, but what if there isn't the supply? I think that was part of not a scarcity mentality in your book, but just that, I can't reiterate it enough, kind of the consciousness. And we're going to have to take another break. And when we come back, there's a lot more to cover. And I want to, you know, I want you to describe what it's like to live in a yurt. I've been in a yurt, and I make a joke, and I do say this on the air, that if I die and go to hell, I'll live in a yurt, because I don't want to live in a yurt. You know, there's a lack of privacy, lack of light, but I think there are people that might be listening that don't even know what a yurt is. And then you talk about slower homes and what that means. And I guess when I finish, I'd like to talk to you about if there were people that you interviewed that regretted it but couldn't find a way back. Does that make sense?
Yes, of course.
they were doing it. They sold everything, their big house in the city, and they invested everything in this. And yet they found like they were stuck. And of course, the last question I want to ask, which you'll have time to think about, two questions. What were some of the biggest challenges you faced in terms of your journey, literally, physical or psychological? And then really the last question is it a better way of life? I think that's the note on which I would like to end. So everybody, please stay here with me. I am having time fly with Philip Vanini, author of Off the Grid, Reassembling Domestic Life. Please stay here with me.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at mrsgreensworld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at mrsgreensworld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Glimmerglass Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@mrsgreensworld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green with some pretty impressive news about the VW Jetta TDI. It's got a turbocharged clean diesel engine. It's 90% cleaner than previous diesel engines. It gets 609 miles on one tank of gas, more than the Prius. That's from Tucson, Arizona to San Diego and halfway back. And it's got an amazing 6-speed Tiptronic transmission. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI or visit chapmantucson.com.
You already know the Habit Store has cabinets, appliances, and paint, but did you know that we have contemporary and vintage furnishings? You might find a gorgeous new sofa offered at 50% off retail price or an antique mahogany dresser priced to sell. You might also find some great weekly specials on the Red Tag Sale. Keep up with the bargains through Facebook, Twitter, and our monthly newsletter. The Habit Store hours are Monday through Friday 9 to 5, Saturdays 8 to 4, and you'll find us on Grant Road just off I-10 in Tucson, Arizona.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And our guest today is certainly giving us a lot to think about in terms of the way we live our lives and the conveniences that we all enjoy by living our very domestic lives. He is the co-author of a book, Reassembling Domestic Life. His name is Philip Vanini, and I'm going to do the long explanation for what you are, Philip, because you deserve it. He's a professor and Canada Research Chair in Public Ethnography and professor in the School of Communications and Culture at Royal Roads University in Victoria, British Columbia. And the book, let's give a shout out now and at the end of the show about how people can purchase the book, because I want them to. I want people to give themselves a gift of enjoying the book, Off the Grid, Reassembling Domestic Life. How did they get the book, Philip?
Super easy. It's all over the internet.
That's all I did. I call it GFGI. Just flip and Google it.
Yeah, it's on Amazon. I've even found it at Walmart.com. So it's really all over the place.
And, how wonderful, though. Let's press pause there and say, this is wonderful.
Yeah, and they even rolled back the price. And in addition to the book, I'll mention that there's also a documentary film. The trailer for that film is available on the website, and the film should be coming out. The film is already available. It hasn't been released yet, but it will be released soon.
Okay, so that's a really great little tidbit for people to know. And you know what? I don't get on the show. I can never feign sincerity. My enthusiasm is usually contagious. So it is really a heartfelt embracing this book. And I can't imagine who wouldn't like it and not be intrigued and informed and captivated by the very, like I said, the very intimate stories of people who have chosen to live off the grid. So we only have less than 15 minutes, which kind of is crazy, but I'd like you to talk a little bit about a yurt and tell people, I don't think everybody knows what a yurt is and what the challenges would be in living that, which for me would be privacy and lighting, but why would anyone want to live in a yurt?
It's cheap and it's convenient.
Okay.
It's also really easy to assemble. So in Canada, there's a company. It's a bit of free advertising for them. They deserve it. It's called Groovy Yurts. And what they do is they import authentic Mongolian yurts. And a bit of background, a yurt is basically a round-shaped structure, not much larger than a large master bedroom, I would say, made of material that is easily available, like cloth, which is on the outside. Wood is used as well. And it's all wrapped around tight by a system of cords. And there is an opening on top of the yurt. It's the roof takes almost a triangular shape at the very top, a spiral shape almost. And there's an opening on top which can be covered by glass, and that provides light. There's typically only one door in a yurt, which is the outside door, and there are no rooms inside. So it's one large room. It's one large round structure. And you know, people that want to live in a yurt, all they have to do is probably spend up to, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 to have one shipped to their land, and it's a fully functioning house.
And that's really a reason. I mean, it certainly is for people that want to not live largely and grandly and making a big imprint. And it's okay though. I don't even feel guilty about saying I would never live in a yurt. It's okay. I was not put on this planet, I hope, to live in a yurt. There's other things in the book that made me excited that I would like to try for kind of like a destination experience, but it's a very challenging life. It's not a comfort-filled life from what I can see, and certainly not always convenient. Let's talk about what you mean by slower homes. There's a whole chapter, and you describe someone in there, I think it was Debbie and David, that qualified for the Olympics in the minimalist of off-grid living. So can you tell us about them?
A slow home is a new concept of sorts that I came up with. It's basically a home which takes a little bit longer to function than a normal home. And by takes a little bit longer, I simply mean that you can't have everything the minute or the second
on demand, right?
On demand, 24/7 to 12 months out of the year. So a slow home, therefore, requires more patience and requires more involvement and requires a bigger picture. If you live in a slow home, you need to think about yourself, what's really important. Do you really need to have your laundry dried in a tumble dryer within the next 45 minutes?
Right.
Do you really need to have your hair blow-dried in the next 10 minutes? If the answers are no, then you might be fit for a slow home, a home that functions with the rhythms of the weather. That is really what a slow home is, a home that functions with energy when that energy is available.
That's even harder to me to think about. I mean, because we are just, you know, type A, fast-paced. And
right.
So that was like, OMG, that would be even more challenging. Patience. But good. But really good.
It's challenging at first, but then you realize that the things that really matter can work.
Yes. Yes. There's that aspect of it as well. What a great message for our life.
The homes that rely exclusively on solar energy have batteries. So you don't necessarily need to stop life when it gets dark or cloudy. But if it's cloudy for 3 or 4 days in a row, then the energy level in your batteries goes down, and so you really want to start thinking about conserving very carefully. And so with a slower home, with a solar home, what you do is you do things when it's sunny. For example, you might use particular appliances like a dishwasher when it's sunny. There are some ironies. I've heard of a couple that had kids who called their kids inside on a sunny day because they could finally play the Wii.
That's adorable. I mean, seriously, I understand. Oh, my gosh.
The kids were used to it.
The kids were used to it.
They could just go outside when it was cloudy, and, you know, they had been asking to play video games, and it was sunny. They could afford it.
It's great. I mean, it's really great. And if for anybody that's ever been around or used a Wii, I mean, I'm a grandmother, and doing that with my grandchildren and my children is just a delightful way to really be together. I mean, you really are having fun and not tuned into a TV. It's a Wii.
And the interesting thing is that, it's an off-grid home. They can play the Wii, too. It's just that it's a bit of a frivolous thing to do, let's admit it, as fun as it can be. You know, you can live a good day without it. But the point there is that if something is important, and perhaps having a good time with your kids or letting them have a good time without you, if it's important, and I think it is, I can wait, and I can wait for a sunny day.
I know. I think that's really funny, though. Come on in. The sun is shining. It's just not your typical message that you send to the kids.
No.
Some of the things, what did people that you met in your two-year journey, what were some of the things that they liked about Connected Life? I mean, the Wii is a perfect example, but were there things that, like, they did keep? Like, you can have a cell phone and be off the grid. And you can have the internet and be off the grid. So what were some of the Connected Life that you found that they continued to enjoy the most?
You named it, the internet. Out of 200 people, I can only recall two that did not have internet access. And how they got that access often is a story in itself. I mean, often...
Right.
Often we saw homes that were perfectly normal and typical, and so they had enough wattage to spare. But others had to be more inventive because they had minimal systems, and so for them, sparing enough watts to power a modem was challenging. But it was really interesting how the internet was omnipresent and television wasn't. I said that almost all the homes had access to the internet. In the same sentence, I should say that very, very few of these homes had cable or satellite television. So it really shows you that it's choices that you make about what matters most in life.
And my daughter lived in an Earthship in Taos, New Mexico. And one of the things that she mentioned, believe it or not, my daughter, yes, she did, and she said one of the things that you really had to be conscious of was your internet use. I mean, she was, 23, 24 years old, but she said, you had the power that you had from the solar storage, and they all had to work as a community for internet use because it does drain the grid. So that was, something she learned and really changed the way that she goes through the world, because you just don't take all that stuff for granted. And it was cold when she came home, and they had wood-burning stoves, but it was not just flip a switch. It was very much more of a conscious kind of lifestyle. Yeah. So while we have time, I really want to talk about people. Were there many people that regretted it and couldn't find a way back? Because I watched one TV special, and they did feature some of those people, that they were very disillusioned, that it was much harder than they really thought. That things went wrong and they were ready to get back to a more urban, more connected life.
Yes. We were very aware of the fact that it would have been really easy to write a very romantic book. We didn't want to do that. We didn't want to sensationalize this, and we didn't want to gloss over the obvious difficulties and challenges. And so of all the things that we did, besides being very sober about the amount of work that it takes, which is present throughout the book, we wanted to highlight the experience of a couple who were enduring those challenges and regretting it. And we did do that by finding a couple in Prince Edward Island on the Atlantic coast who had moved to this idyllic island from central Canada, from Ontario, with a plan of creating a agritourism business. The trouble there was that most people will tell you that to sustain a small business of that kind, you need to have a lot of tourists, a lot of guests coming throughout the year, and they only had that for about 2 months out of the year, in the summer. So they couldn't sustain it financially. Because they couldn't sustain it financially, they were not able to make the necessary improvements to their system. Their system was quite small and quite demanding. And so they found themselves having to make a lot of sacrifices, and therefore they were at a point where they were now taking jobs outside the house every day of the week in order to make enough money to improve their system. And when you live off-grid, it's very, very difficult to have both partners in a household that work full-time away from the house all day. Because to put
there's
it
so
in
much
words,
to do.
Yeah, there's so much to do, and to put in their words, you come home and you want things.
Right, right.
And things were not always available. We've talked about slow homes. You can't just come home at 5:30 and expect everything to be ready for you. So they were at the point where not only were they incredibly stressed out again, to quote their words, but they were also considering moving away. They had put their house on the market. But at the same time, there was a lot of conflict in their experience, because they knew that was paradise. They knew that's exactly everything they wanted. They just couldn't make it happen financially.
Right.
And you think of off-grid living as independent living, yes and no. There's still some things that you can't make yourself, or you can't fashion yourself. Solar panels are one of those things. You can't
right.
make your own, right? And so the necessity of having a steady cash flow was really the big challenge there. And it's the big challenge with other people as well.
Yeah, it's really huge. And it's been a while since, you know, we schedule the shows so far out. And I'm sure I watched that on your film. And mm-hmm. Because that every detail of that is very clear to me. And it made me really sad, because I think they wanted to make it work, and it was basically undercapitalized. It was a business model that was not sustainable.
Yeah,
and that would be exhausting. I wanted to ask you this too: were you ever scared, like when you read? I read about, you know, you got stuck in somewhere in the middle of nowhere, which you were frequently.
I can tell it. Yeah,
and it
That's
was
a good story.
Tell the story.
Well,
I was scared.
I am courageous to a point. There are certain things that I don't do well with. One of those is grizzly bears, just because they seem rather unpredictable to me.
They're really big.
So I was always cautious in environments where I know there were a lot of grizzly bears, or polar bears, for that matter, even more unpredictable. But speaking of polar bears, there was a time when we were in the Arctic, so actually above the Arctic Circle, and we had to drive from point A to point B, and the only way to do that was driving on an ice road. You might have seen the show on TV, Ice Road Truckers.
Uh-huh, yes.
Which is shot in the Mackenzie Delta.
Right.
Mackenzie Delta in the Northwest Territories by the Beaufort Sea, and we were traveling the same roads that those guys were on. As a matter of fact, we saw them. And at one time, the visibility was down to zero because everything was white. The river was white. The snow banks were white. The sky was white. And how do you drive in that? I made a mistake, and I just took the snowbank for the road, and we got stuck. And so that was a bit scary.
Terrifying.
Polar bears or anything like that, but it was minus 30, and help needed to arrive quickly, and the satellite phone that we had with us, we made a call, it didn't get picked up, and so we started asking ourselves, what do we do? Fortunately, it all ended well, because someone that was driving the opposite way saw us, stopped us, and everyone up there drives with big, strong trucks with ropes and all kinds of things in the back, and they pull us out of the ditch, and soon enough, we were on our way. And it all ended really well, but I felt really out of place. Where I live, everything is green, nothing is white, and I actually was teased a little bit by the local when they found out where I was from.
And everything was white. I mean, I have watched that show, and it's just, I mean, again, it's... I don't see myself as an excellent adventurer. I mean, I think it's exciting to go do a zip line in Costa Rica with, you know, really all the kind of safety hatches connected, but it's fun to live vicariously. So we just have a minute left. I want you to say, this is what I want to say to everybody. If you want a copy of Philip's book and Jonathan Taggart's book, just Google Off the Grid. Google his name and you'll find it. It's Off the Grid, Reassembling Domestic Life. You will be so happy if you read this book. It's delightful, informative, and very much on purpose. So everybody, thanks for joining us. Philip, thanks for doing what you did and sharing with us. Tuesday, Green Divas on January 20th, a fun new radio network that's rocking it. And on the 24th, Ben Simon, founder and executive director of the Food Recovery Network. It's all about recovering food waste on college's campuses. Make it a great green week, everybody. Thanks for being a part of a great show.